Welcome to the Jess Larson Show on Innovation and Leadership. On this episode, I'm really excited to have a very famous scientist, author who I wanted to have on for a number of years, and we were lucky to get him. Albert Laszlo Barabasi, thank you so much for making time for the show.
Jess, it's going to be fun.
I think so. Can you tell people a little bit about what you do at work? And we're going to focus a lot today on your book, The Formula, but why don't you tell people about some of the other publications and that you've done?
Sure. I'm officially a network scientist, which is a new breed of scientist, meaning that I focus on how networks emerge in nature and society and technology, like how people are connected through their acquaintances and professional relationships, how the genes in our cells are linked together by various interactions, and what that means for disease, all the way to kind of the networks in our brain and how that actually leads to brain activity and so on. So really, I have a lab for about 25, 30 people who focus on the mathematical aspects of networks and typically using big data and detailed description of real systems to understand their organizing principles.
You know, you've been widely recognized. You know, your TED Talk has over 250,000 views, things like this. I'm really excited to talk about The Formula, but maybe to begin with, can you give people kind of a premise for the book if they haven't read it yet?
Sure. So one of the things that we started to do about 10 years ago in my lab is to ask, how do we apply this kind of data-driven approach to individual success? And first, actually, we thought that it would be the network angle that is really important. And we thought, hey, there's so much data now emerging, particularly in the science space of how people collaborate with whom, what are the joint institutions. So we could actually build up very detailed networks of scientific collaboration. And that may help us understand how success emerges in science. But as we kind of dwelled into the subject, we soon realized that, A, the problem is much bigger than scientific success, and B, networks are only part of the story. So you know, the book, The Formula, that I have it here as a cheat sheet for me, right? It's really born out of my lab seeing quantitative investigation of how does really science success emerge in many different disciplines. And particularly, we did a very deep dive in my lab into scientific success as well as artistic success. So, you know, lots of books have been written about success. What distinguishes this from the many others? And the way I think of, I read many books about success, but most success books are either somebody shares their personal experience or somebody distills the patterns that characterize success from, say, looking at 10 or 100 successful individuals. And from a data science perspective, I have a deep problem with it. And the reason I have a deep problem with that is that we don't have control groups. So let me give an example. You may look at 100 successful individuals and find out that 90% of them start their day at 5 a.m. And you would conclude, okay, the key to success is to start working at 5 a.m. But then you would find 10 million individuals who start at 5 a.m. who are not successful at all. Right. So in order to really understand success from a scientific perspective, you do need to have you must focus not only on the successful individuals, but you also have to focus on people working in the very same domain who may not be so successful. So that's exactly what we did. We ended up rebuilding the career of every single scientist that worked since 1900 till today, which included a few Nobel Prize winners and many, many individuals you never heard of, right? But we also rebuilt a career for 500,000 artists all around the world, where they exhibited, what institutions they engaged with, and so on. Once again, you know, having a couple of famous artists among them, but many, many artists you will never heard of. So by using these massive amounts of data, our goal was to understand what are the patterns that characterize success. And what I tried to do in The Formula is to distill these ideas in a way that anybody without a math background can read it. But those who care about the math background, you get actually, they're looking at our research papers, what we have all the data and all the details of how we arrived at the conclusions described.
Well, you know, before we started, I told you that I've read the book multiple times. Well, I don't read anything. I've listened to it on Audible many times. Have my staff read it. I hand it out to CEOs like crazy. You know, it's interesting for me. You've got all these stories, fighter pilots, sports athletes, so many different realms. And I think one of the favors you do to begin with is defining success as the rewards the community gives back to you, you know, because success could be defined so many ways. And so like, if you're, you know, if you're an athlete or something, this is, you know, with the dollars you get back in endorsements. If this is, if you're a scientist, how many citations do you get? You know, I feel like that is such a fundamental starting point that helps with understanding the rest of it, knowing that that is what we're solving for. But I think for me, what I'm so fascinated about is the way that you crystallized the idea of the community's opinion of you as a multiplier on your own performance. And I think for me, so often I have thought about it as an addition. Hey, if you've got it, you know, if your performance, you know, how good is your product? Because, you know, this show is largely high growth CEOs, founder CEOs, right? And so it's like, how good is your product? Do you have the best product? Do you have product market fit? That's always what's getting talked about, right? And you get led to believe, like, you know, PR or people's opinion of you or who you're associated with, that's like cute, nice two add-ons. And they become much more important if your product isn't any good. But like, if you have a good enough product, you don't have to worry about all that. And I want you to jump in here and tell me how I'm thinking about this wrong. But what's so fascinating to me is how you gave such language to dissect that situation of like, well, if you do have good enough observable performance, you probably will get the word of mouth, which is the multiplier. And if it's hard for the lay customer to define the difference or the performance difference between you and the competitors, the opinion of the group, what does the market say is the best product, has such outsized growth on whether you're going to get all these goals you promised your investors or not. How would you say that, better or different?
Well, I mean, let's go back, right? And let's go back and talk about what success is, right? And this was a big dilemma when I was writing this book, right? Because there are so many definitions of success out there. And one of the things I tried to get out from chapter one is that I don't talk in this book about most definition of success, which is the internal success, right? So let's get that out of the way, right? You know, just the fact that I made it in time for the interview could be actually a measure or a satisfaction and a measure of success for me, right? But that is my internal success. And that's very valid, right? You got to have your internal successes and wins on a daily basis to feel good in your skin. But this is not what this book is about, right? And the reason why this is not is that when we started to kind of look at success, we said, well, what are the different measures of success? And you just yourself said, you know, it depends on where you are. If you are in a business, maybe it's money, maybe it's market share. If you're a scientist, it may be citation. If you're a musician, it's sales and how many people come to your concerts and so on and so forth. And then our goal was to connect, how does that success measure connect to your performance? And that's where we had the first kind of insight or realization or like kind of like confrontation with reality, that how do performance and success relate to each other? And so the way I define it in the book is that performance is what you do and success is what is being perceived of that performance. Is it observed? Is it acknowledged? And eventually, is it rewarded? In other words, your performance is about you, but your success is about us, the community. And let me break it down a little bit, because this is really the key. If we don't get this right, nothing else that we talk about really matters, right? So really the big issue here is that we learn very much in early in school that, you know, you gotta have performance. You go to school to learn, you know, math or music or whatever you want to do, right? You go to the sports class to learn how to run and everything. And all of that throughout the schooling is about performance, performance, and performance. The claim is that you got to be good at something, right? Whatever that is. And that is absolutely necessary. And the way I think about this book is never about how to take someone without a performance and turn it into a successful individual. You must have performance, but is that enough? And what I learned in school, and you probably did, and everybody in all of these listeners, is that if you're good at something, you will be successful. And that's what the connection that is being proved in this particular book. And the reason why this is not so trivial, because when you look at the data, it turns out there are lots of people who are good at something, and a very few get acknowledged or get the success for it. So really, the book is always kind of trying to probe, what's the connection between performance and success? And the simple math is like that. The simple math comes down to the fact that success is very measurable. It's money, it's citations, it's visibility, and so on. And in most cases, performance is not. And that duality of unknown performance and very measurable success is really that kind of leads to all the frustration and all the exciting things that we see about successful individuals.
Well, I think the thing that is so helpful about that to me, that I'm constantly talking to CEO friends, or, you know, I'll have some famous guests on the show and then it'll end and then they'll be talking to me about, like, oh, should I write a book? Should I have a podcast, Jess, or these kind of things. The reason that I bring you up to them a lot of the times is I think I love your story of the research on the fighter pilots and how there's this, I want to say French guy, correct me, who had many more, took down many more planes than the Red Baron during World War II. And yet his performance wasn't recognized. He didn't have the reputation of it because in that case, the Allies didn't need him as a, you know, as war, as propaganda, where the Germans really needed the Red Baron. And so they propped him up and everybody found out about him to the point that he's in Snoopy cartoons, however many decades later, right? And to me, it's this idea that, like, it exposes performance isn't enough. And, you know, I think so many of the professionals, the more serious business people, they look down their nose so much on the people who got really good at building a reputation, but it's a little bit substance free, you know, low performance, but they managed to be friends with the right people. And they're so annoyed with those folks and trying not to be associated with them that then they don't do any work on building their reputation.
And I would even challenge you on that those people who, let's say, are good at networking, that they don't do any work. I'm not so sure about that, right? That is also a skill, right? And which we choose, or exactly how you said, you may choose or not choose to invest into that, right? But let's go and take it apart of why are we so frustrated about the lack of performance or the perceived lack of performance and success. And the issue with that is that performance is very, very hard to measure, right? And this is not to say that you cannot distinguish somebody that is good at something versus somebody who is weak at something, right? That's easy to do in most areas, right? The problem is that in most areas, we don't have a stopwatch. That is, if you're a runner, you have one measure of performance, how fast you run, and we have very, very reproducible way of measuring that. And hence, and this is what I show in the book, when it comes to individual sports, there's a one-to-one correspondence between performance and success. The faster you run, the more acknowledged you are as a runner, the more money you get, and everything comes with that. What's the stopwatch for a writer? What's the stopwatch for a teacher? What's the stopwatch for a doctor? So in most professions, we lack actually a one-dimensional measure of performance. And that's really the key, because performance is really multidimensional, right? Even for a doctor, it's not only how good you are at diagnosing disease, but also how good you are of matching that diagnosis with cures. And even very, very important, how do you deal with the patient, right? What are the skills that you have? Because, you know, treating something is not just simply take this pill, but it's actually like a holistic process. So in most areas, and I don't even get me started as a teacher, how many measures of performance you should have to really do your job right. So what happens in most areas is that we don't have a one-dimensional or any kind of really pure performance measure. So then the question is, when we have But we have differences between people, right? And you have lots of great teachers, lots of great doctors coexisting with not so great doctors. And so how does it come that somebody becomes a superstar in those areas where you don't have a way of measuring what they do, right? And this is, you know, kind of the claim of the book is that the less performance is measurable, the more the networks take away and they drive the success. And, you know, and then we can dive in if you want to what this network means and how does it work. But there is this dichotomy of the collective versus the individual. And the less the individual performance is measurable, the more, the bigger role the collective and the community has of defining your success.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Maybe the place to take it then is when you think about individuals who have objectively produced higher performance that might be more recognized by insiders than by the general customers of their market, you know, their community, mm-hmm. right? And mm-hmm. yep. they're annoyed. Like the example I brought up, you know, my commercial real estate fund, we're building these short-term rental resorts like Airbnbs, right? And there's currently a YouTuber mm-hmm. right now who has hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of thousands of views. And the way he teaches his classes about how to be an Airbnb investor, he has decided to not include the cost of land when he calculates a return on investment. You know, something that if he was to put in an investment prospectus, the Securities Commission would charge him with fraud, right? But it's just YouTube. And when anybody brings it up mm-hmm. in his YouTube comments, he just defends himself. And for me, it's like, I just feel bad for the people who are listening to him, right? And mm-hmm. he's winning because he gets to put, you know, on his YouTube descriptions, mm-hmm. he gets to say, you know, 600% rate of return. Well, yeah. If you leave out a bunch of the investment, the return would look like that, wouldn't it? Right? Okay.
Now, this would be actually the area that I would say that the formula is not about, right? Because the way, and I'm going to just take you on face value, right? This is clearly a flagrant claim, right? So this is not reality. So it's not a true performance, but it's a made-up performance. But there are many other areas where there is true performance.
I'm going to interrupt you for one second. The point I'm trying to bring up is his YouTube performance. His attention on YouTube in that performance is extremely well because the unlearned people watching YouTube that don't recognize how flawed his calculations are don't know how to evaluate his performance, his investment performance. And so his YouTube performance is crazy, even though his investing performance probably doesn't deserve it.
But I would flip it the other way around, right? So it's not about him, but it's about you, right? Because you say, I have actually the right calculation. So why don't I get acknowledged at the same level as he? And I think that is the real dilemma, not of how he achieves that, but why don't we as a society acknowledge everybody who tells the truth and has the right performance at the level that is proportionate to their performance? And obviously, you pointed to yourself, this is a multidimensional problem. He has a YouTube performance and not a financial performance, right? he is raising in this particular issue. So, but that is really the dilemma, right? The dilemma is that a few individuals get pulled out from this pool of people who all have the performance and they all say the truth and they all say the right things. And we kind of acknowledge them as superstars, and the rest are kind of left behind. And that's the network effect. And to my mind, the network effect is the cleanest in the art space. And the reason I think it's a clear, and then you mentioned before we started this conversation that you wanted to be an artist as you started out your career. So what happened there?
I was drawing, I was in figure drawing class, and my my mentor, who's now my business partner, still 21 years later in the investment fund, his words were ringing in my ears, where he said, Jess, do you realize if you got rich enough, you could draw for whatever movies you want, because they'd be your movies, instead of drawing for other people's movies? And I was sitting there in figure drawing class, listening to this book from a very wealthy man who said, if you want a good job, you're going to need a good education so you can get a good degree so you can get a good job. If you want to be really, really wealthy, what you mostly need is guts. Those other things are nice, but you need the guts. And so I sat my pencil down, took my Walkman off, called my fiance, asked her if she wanted to get married during finals week because I was quitting. And we moved to California to be entrepreneurs.
Jeez, that's a good story. So clearly you had the guts. I also started out wanted to become a sculptor. That was in Transylvania and Romania. And I realized that it was virtually impossible under communism to become a sculptor because it was only 5 spots at the university. And I chose the easy way out and I became a nuclear physicist eventually. But I had this kind of affinity and interest in art. And so we also focused on art in the art space. And the art space is particularly interesting for me, right? Because is this thing, what I'm holding, an artwork? Or it's a glass, right? And it totally depends on the context, right? If you see it here on my desk and there's even water in it, as you will say a few minutes ago, then it's purely a glass, right? If you, however, see it under in the box, in the MoMA, right, with a famous artist's name under it, then it's worthless. So the question is, how do you value particularly contemporary art? And how does success emerge when you cannot look at the object itself and decide what's its value? And you yourself said in the earlier that there are these shows where, is it $7 or 7 million, right? And people cannot make the difference. And the reason, so that kind of raised the question, how does success emerge in art when there is no measurable performance? And so we went after that by getting access to this data set that had 500,000 artists' career. And we ended up kind of exploring how do you become a famous artist, really? And you do so through institutions. Institutions here are galleries and museums, but non-profit and for-profit spaces that eventually exhibit your work. And through the multiple exhibitions, value is built up. And sooner or later, you will also get in the auction market. And there's something measurable in terms of like financial success as well. But the key is that it's the institutions that really kind of create the artist. So we said, let's map out the institutional network that is responsible for that. And we did so by collecting all institutions, like a museum to a gallery. If, say, a gallery exhibited first in an artist exhibited in the gallery, next is shown in the museum. And why would you connect actually institutions if they show the same artist? Well, because if they show the same artist, they have a similar vision of what contemporary art is, right? And they have access to the same artist, which is also not trivial, right? I want to do an Andy Warhol show, may not get the works to do that, right? And so on. And then the end result was this beautiful network of like tens of thousands, like 20,000 institutions, museums all over the world connected to each other. And what was amazing about this network is that once I placed artists on this network, say, what are the first exhibits? We were able to predict whether he or she will move out in prestige of the institutions or will stay where he or she was or even go down. And it was incredibly, incredibly accurate. We could really precisely tell whether this artist will have a career 20 years later or will be forgotten. Why could we do that? Because it is the network, the institutional network that creates the artists, and your position in that really kind of defines who you are. And it is the links on this network that really kind of determine your future trajectory. In the same way, say in the business world, going to the right schools and building the right network up may actually open you professional opportunities that if you use right, you could become a successful businessman or whatever you want to be, right? But what is special about the art space is that we could map out the precise network that creates this success in the art space, and we were able to be predictive. Now, forget art, right? The same thing actually happens in most other areas. It is people and institutions, and often institutions are people, that really play a key role in driving the success of an individual. And if I want to go back to the original language, they play a key role in observing your performance, acknowledging it, and then giving you opportunities by which you can actually, use your performance in a way to be successful with it. And most of us in some way are artists, right? Because our performance is very, very difficult to measure objectively. So that idea that I learned in school, and particularly artists think a lot about, all I have to do is just do my work, and then sooner or later, I will be discovered. This is what doesn't seem to be working in the current world, right? So yes, you have to be a good artist. Yes, you must have performance. But if you stop there, that's not enough for success. You also need to acknowledge what are the forces and the networks that are responsible for the success in your space. And that depends on it. In art is different from business and is different from medicine and so on. And then you need to master that network, acknowledge it, engage with it, if you want to be really successful at what you do.
So again, this concept was so helpful to me. It's like the 80-20 principle, Richard Koch, Pareto principle, the idea that there's these small number of things that make a huge difference. And it's like, so many people, like you said, have good performance, but they're missing that key. It's like they've got a great sports car, they just don't have enough gasoline to get very far. We're like, those yep. networks are the gasoline, right? And I look in business and like, what conferences are, if you're a CEO, what conferences are you speaking at? What media publications are writing about you? What are other people saying about you on LinkedIn? You know, who's talking about having purchased from you and what their experience was? Like those networks have such an influence. And so, you know, I don't know what you'll think about this, but like my version of trying to implement your knowledge there is this podcast. I engineered my own network of people to associate with by trying to scratch their back first. Hey, come on my show and talk about your famous company. Come on my show, talk about what you're doing. And over time, as I got higher and higher profile people, it was like compound interest where like it just keeps going up. Who's willing to come on the show? You know, we had Samara Cohen, who manages $6 trillion for BlackRock, right? And movie stars like Danny Glover. Yep. And last week we had, Kevin Bacon's wife, Kira Sedgwick on the show, right? And it's funny because I saw one of my co-hosts for a bunch of my miniseries is one of my best friends. Her name's Lindsay Hadley. She's got a great podcast called Lindsay Hadley Podcast, and we co-host together. And I saw this like crazy. She used to work for me. She used to be my employee when we started our charity 14 years ago called Child Rescue. She did absolutely great and then went on to bigger and better things, throwing concerts with John Legend and Metallica and the biggest bands for charity. And all of a sudden, she's like advising billionaires and celebrities on their charities. And so then everybody else wants to associate with her because she's associated with them. Without actually being a celebrity, she is like a major celebrity in our friend groups because she's one degree of, because she does this work for Kevin Bacon, because, you know, this billionaire lends her his $40 million castle and they have a charity event with Gerard Butler, right? And so I was like, I'm just going to invent my own. And so we're, I think, 840 episodes in. And it's funny because this Thursday, we're doing a party in Beverly Hills. A billionaire's hosting for us. We've got multiple billionaires there. We've got multiple movie stars. We've got venture capitalists, guys who built $100 million companies. There's about 40 of us getting together. And there's no way I could get into that party if I wasn't throwing it. Do you know what I mean? Like, this is not like my snowboard buddies or my friends from art school. Like, I don't normally get to hang out, right? But because I'm throwing the party, not only do I get to go, but everybody's going to find out, like, everybody who's coming knows whose party it was, right? So it's kind of like being like the not so popular kid at school who gets to throw the high school party, who all of a sudden becomes like, I'm not saying I'm going to become cool, but I'm going to become one notch cooler than I was. Yeah. It's my hope.
I always say that, always the high school losers are the one who's winning in the long run, right? And the geeks are always winning the game in the long run. But what you just described, what you're doing to the podcast, is a typical situation that we see in the art space, right? You start out in some peripheral company, some peripheral galleries, and then as you kind of start engaging with better and better institutions, you are being observed by a wider range of curators and professionals who, if they like what you do, they start opening up doors for you to say, okay, show some of your work here as well. I like what you are doing and so on. So this is the traditional kind of path through this network. And the problem what happens in most areas is that the networks feel invisible to us, right? And in some cases, they are truly invisible to us. But they're invisible because we chose not to conceptualize it and not to think about it as a network. And I think that's what kind of network science, an area that I kind of pioneered about 20 years ago, has done to us, is to really start kind of, you know, like whatever problem you're trying to address, you say, there is a network behind it. What is it? Can I map it out? If I can't map it out, then of course you don't know whose friends is whom, right? But the you start approximating it. And it's not hard to map it out because one of the key features of the networks is that there are hubs, right? Like Google on the World Wide Web, like giant routers on the internet, and so on. And the hubs are always easy to find. And those hubs are holding the whole network together, right? So you don't have to map out the full network to have a good sense of where the hubs are and where do you have to navigate in order to succeed. All artists know that they need to kind of end up in MoMA if they want to kind of be really acknowledged as major artists, right? And it's not hidden, right? The path to that may not be obvious, right? So, but if you develop a network-based thinking and you kind of acknowledge, and this is the key, I think, in my mind, why this research was humbling, right? If you acknowledge the limitations of performance, then you can start engaging with the network, right? Because there is a moment beyond which you cannot be better at what you do, right? And there's lots of psychological research where they look at how performance emerges, for example, in musicians or even in reading and things like that. And we know the pattern. There is a fast path of learning. And then, you know, if you're a musician, kind of in your 30s, you peak out, meaning that you will maintain that ability to play piano or violin for another 20 to 30 years, but you're not going to get much better than that, right? And that what happens in violin happens in most areas, right? There's a quick path of learning, and then you become good at what you do. And then you stay at that level. Once you reach that peak, once you kind of maximize your performance, what else can you do? And that's where the network comes in, right? Because it's not enough to have that performance and maximize performance. Now you have to start engaging with the network. So this perspective, what I tried to give in the formula, is gives you a way to think about it. Given where you are, what do you need to do for success, right? If you're a high school kid who's learning to be a musician, the first thing to do, go and practice, right? You got to learn how to play that guitar or violin or you name it. But once you kind of got to that age and that level of expertise that is kind of accepted from you, then more practice doesn't give you a huge advantage. You have to keep it up. But then you have to start engaging with other areas of life to say, what do I do with this gift or this performance that I got? And that's where the network comes in.
You know, I agree with you on the humbling part. And I think the other reason that I'm so passionate about your book is the optimism part. This idea that if I have genuinely put in my deliberate practice hours to a level of mastery, but I'm not seeing the success that I want, that I'm not stuck. And that the idea of the networks is not something you have to be blessed from God to get. It's, like you said, it's another skill.
It's another skill that if you're willing to work with it, you will get it. And I think if you talk about optimism, I always consider the last chapter to be the most optimistic, right? Which is about the age and creativity, right? And if I know this is a podcast and most people don't see me, but those who do, actually probably will notice the white hair that I got here. And this is a very interesting question because there is a belief in science in other areas that if you want to be creative, you have to be young. And in science, that is very severe, right? Even Einstein himself said once that that if you're a physicist, which I am, right, beyond 30, you don't actually make any more discoveries. If you haven't done your discovery by 30, then never going to happen. That's what Einstein said. And you would ask, why would he say that, right? It would be age discrimination today. And he said so because he looked around the people that he admired in physics, particularly the generation that did quantum mechanics, and they were all in their 20s or early 30s when they made their biggest discoveries. So one of the research we did that ended up in this book, leading to this book, was to ask, is it really true that youth equals creativity, that you need to be young to kind of make something great? And how did we do that? Well, for example, we looked at all the scientists and we asked, when does a scientist publish his or her highest impact work? And, you know, different scientists are at different levels. So your highest impact work may not be noticed by anybody else, but it was your best in your career, right? And when we looked at the data, we first saw that indeed it turns out that most scientists publish their highest impact work in the first 10, 15 years of their career. And then after that, the chance of publishing something high drops very, very fast. So if you take that particular data seriously, the chance that I would make a discovery that would overcome what I did before in my career is less than 1%. So I might as well give up and don't do any more science, because statistically, I have no chance to make anything better than I did before. But then we looked deeper into the data and we realized that this conclusion was biased by, purely driven by productivity. It turns out that most scientists do most of the publishing or discoveries early in their career, simply because that's when they publish a lot. And as time goes on, they stop actually being active in science and they stop publishing because they become deans or become department chairs or because the illness comes in, family responsibilities or whatever. So when you look at productivity, productivity drops just as much as your chance of making a big discovery. To make a long story short, when we actually run the math on the problem, it turns out that there is no correlation whatsoever between age and creativity or age and your highest discovery. There's a huge correlation between productivity and age, which means that most people don't do great things later in their life because they stop doing it. And the scientists or musicians or you name it, those who are willing to continue and try, they have just as much chance to discover at the very end of their life their biggest thing as early in their career. And in the book, actually, I describe the case of this chemist, Nobel Prize winner, who was a Yale University professor, and he was forcefully retired by Yale. And he went actually to Virginia Commonwealth University, opened a new lab there. And after retirement, he made the discovery that eventually 50 years later, at 85, got him the Nobel Prize, right? And he's a beautiful example of a case that those who don't give up, right, they can actually continue making discoveries. And then once we made this discovery, we saw it everywhere, right, in all areas. And my favorite ones is you talked about entrepreneurship, that this is true for entrepreneurship as well, right? Yes, of course, when you look at the Silicon Valley, it's a kind of a glossy publication. They always feature somebody in their 30s or 20s or early 30s as the entrepreneur of the year. But when you actually look at the data, and economists have looked at that, it turns out, what's the chance that you actually start a successful business? And it turns out that somebody who starts a business in their 50s, they're three times more likely to actually have an exit with their business than those who do it in their 20s or 30s. So yes, actually, you can actually be just as successful no matter at what stage of your life, as long as you're willing to do that. It's just that young people have lots of energy and they keep trying and trying over. So the productivity when you are young is high, but kind of creativity doesn't wane with time.
Well, I love that. And most of us entrepreneurs who didn't end up becoming a billionaire by 30, we also love having it scientifically proven. We're more likely when we start the business older. But
as long as you're willing to stay with it, you have to try again and again. Yep. That's the key, yep. Right?
You know, I know we're almost out of time. We got to have you back on the show. This is too much fun. We got to have you back again. But maybe with our last few minutes, I think one of the elements that I'm fascinated with, but I feel the least, like I understand the least, is Q factor. Can you talk about how you define Q factor or how I recognize my own Q factor, any of this?
Yes. So that's what I'm just saying. So because this, again, originally came from science and then now it's been applied to many other areas. And the question is, you know, the problem is that we do have something intrinsic. People have something intrinsic that really bring to any area that you work in, whether you're a musician or a scientist and so on. But how do you capture that, right? Because at the end, you only see the products of their work, And off the product now is really a product of your ability to do something, as well as your ability to engage with the network to become successful at it, right? And so in case of science, we ended up kind of rebuilding the career of all the scientists. And then one of the observations we had is that there were scientists who kept kind of making one discovery after the other one, right? I mean, they had lots of crappy papers as well, but they had a record of here and there kind of making a big hit. And so they were able to keep it up. And then there were others who were doing lots of stuff out and it was always small impact. So we started to kind of run the math and say, what really determines your impact? And we said, well, and in the end, to make a long story short, what we realized is that a success is driven by a very simple formula, which is the idea that you start a project, whether that's a new business, whether it's a new idea for a research paper, and ahead of the time, you don't know what will be, how good that idea is, right? We all think that our idea is the best one we got right now, right? But we don't know objectively what it is. So let's consider that as a random number, unknown to us, right? And what we realize is that the way somebody who has repeat activity works is that their success is really a product of this internal value, which we call the Q factor, times this random variable, right? Which is effectively the idea. Now, let's pause for a second and you say, well, if you are an experienced scientist or an experienced entrepreneur, probably your ideas are better. And this is what we showed, that the ideas are, everybody has the same access to the same group of ideas. So people who have, let's say, higher Q factor, higher ability, higher experience, don't seem to have better ideas than those who have less, right? The difference is this Q factor, because the output is really the random idea times the Q factor. And if you have a high Q factor, then a weak idea turns into mediocre or something, right? However, a mediocre idea grows into something strong. And if you have a high Q factor and you hit across a good idea, that becomes something really big. And the key reason why this became really interesting scientifically for us, because when we figured out a way of, in some areas, to measure the Q factor, and it turned out the Q factor to be independent of age. And so what it seems to be that when you start a certain area, whether you're a researcher or kind of entrepreneur, you bring with you right after, out of your education, whether you got that degree or not, in your case, right? You're bringing a certain ability, which we measure as a Q factor, and that Q factor stays there throughout the life, and it doesn't seem to be improving or dropping down. But then you pick ideas up, right? I'm going to start a podcast. I'm going to write a book. I'm going to start a company, right? And all of these ideas that we have to kind of bring that to success. And some of those ideas are good and some of them are bad. And if you have a high Q factor and you hit across a great idea, that's a really huge success. And if you have a high Q factor, as long as you keep trying and that comes back, right, you need to take your Q factor for a ride. If you try enough, sooner or later, you will hit across this big idea, right? Because those ideas are coming randomly to you. So this was really surprising to me, because when we started this research, I would have never thought that we can really quantify this internal ability. And most important, I was convinced that even if there is such a thing as Q factor, my Q factor has improved significantly in the last 30 years, as I'm a so much more experienced person than I was 30 years ago when it comes to science and many other areas. But the data indicates otherwise. The data shows that really that ability that I started my scientific career with, and that enthusiasm and ambition and willingness to try things, is my Q factor. And that has stayed with me throughout my life. And I think I have a Q factor for science, right? And if I really want to show that, the best way is keep doing science and trying over and over so that I can take it for a ride. It can manifest itself. And now replace science with business, with music or things like that. And effectively it says, if you have that ability, you have to keep trying over and over and over, because you have to wait for that random number, that random idea that is a good idea to come along so that really your Q factor manifests itself.
Can I repeat that back to you in my words and you tell me where I'm getting it wrong. To me, it seems like this Q factor is like the ability to connect the dots when you come across an opportunity. Your ability to connect the opportunities and multiply the opportunity or the insight you've been given. Maybe it's kind of like Michael Jordan didn't make a lot of money playing baseball. Why don't we all figure out what our basketball is and mm-hmm. double down on that? And like, I wish that I could sit in a room by myself and just read financial reports like Warren Buffett. He's basically my business hero. And eventually I came to the conclusion that I'm much more like Richard Branson, where, you know, the guy started 500 companies and 300 of them are still in business, right? And they're both billionaires who gave half their money to charity, like I want to do. But as much as I wish I was Warren Buffett, and I'm not saying I don't have any of those traits, and I have studied his stuff extensively for the last 10 years trying to inculcate as much of it as I can. Like, I was kind of lying to myself that I could sit still, and only be a passive investor and just analyze. And I don't know if this is a set thing, but like, it doesn't feel like that's my basketball. Like, you know, Michael Jordan is a great baseball player. He's a better baseball player than any of us. He just wasn't the best in the world, right? Even if I could be like Warren Buffett, I probably can't be a Warren Buffett, Michael Jordan. And so I need to figure out like where my Q factor is to double down on, or correct me here.
Yes. And it's interesting because the Warren Buffett example and the Michael Jordan example, so we have this admiration for performance, right? But the reason we admire them is because they were able to combine it with success, with outcomes, right? And so Warren Buffett, if he would be doing the same cracking of the numbers and in his bedroom and not built actually a big hedge fund from it, right? And do what he did with the money, even give it to charity and so on, he would not be your hero, right? And how many Warren Buffetts are there on performance who may have had the brains to analyze financial data, but never had the brains to build a company out of it, right? So and he's a good example. Richard Branson, a good example is that, yeah, you have to have the performance. You have to have that something that Warren Buffett's case, it is the ability to see the numbers, right? And to see the performance of the company. Michael Jordan is to do what he does in the basketball court, right? But that's not enough. You also have to couple it with engaging with the right network to bring your Q factor to have a value. And that's what the formula is about. And I think that's what you learn from my book. And if you would know how to use it, you will be able to give lots of money to charity at the end.
I'm trying. I'm working on it. This has been so fun. Thank you so much for making the time.
Thank you. This is fun. And send me a link once you're out. And I'm curious how it comes out.
Great.
Okay.
Bye, everyone.